Where does art come from? Why did Leonardo paint the Mona Lisa smile exactly the way he did? Poet Edward Hirsch says we should thank the Duende. It's what he calls the sprite of creativity that inspires some artists to soar. But there is something dark about the Duende. Hirsch talks about it in a book called The Demon and the Angel. Hirsch writes frequently for The New Yorker and American Poetry Review, and he's published 5 volumes of poetry. His most celebrated book is How to Read a Poem. Hirsch told Anne Strainchamps why he was driven to tap the source of artistic inspiration.
I wanted to see what happens to certain works of art that allow them to attain the summit. I mean, all works of art aren't the same, and all poems by Rainer Maria Rilke aren't the same, and all poems by Lorca aren't the same. Some of them are infused with a special kind of spirit. And it occurred to me that something infused Jackson Pollock when he went and started making his black paintings, and something infused Paul Klee when he started doing those an extraordinary series of angel paintings. And so I wanted to see what happened, what kind of liftoff took place that distinguished certain works of art from some other works of art.
So for you, it's something more than just they practiced and practiced and practiced, and one day they were really good.
Well, that's a lovely thought. And certainly practice, practice, practice is a huge amount of it. I can't imagine a great artist or musician or poet who wasn't entirely devoted to his or her art. But that being said, it does strike me that art is never entirely at the dispensation of the will, and that no matter how hard one works, in special works of art, in extraordinary works of art, something special takes place.
One of those special things that takes place you call the demon, or you borrow a term from the Spanish poet Federico García Lorca, the duende. Tell me what the duende means.
All over Spain and Latin America, really, the duende is a sort of folk figure for a kind of trickster figure, an imp, a sprite, something like the Yiddish dibbik, a figure who steals your keys and causes you trouble, minor troubles, but troubles nonetheless. But in Andalusia, where Lorca is from, it meant something else. It meant that an artist was taken over by this spirit. It was something like artistic inspiration, but artistic inspiration with a particular kind of anguish. So in Andalusia, they'll say that a singer has duende, or a flamenco dancer has duende, or a bullfighter has duende. And what that means is some special power, some overwhelming force kicks in that will lift this particular artist to the summit of his or her work.
But there's a kind of darkness to it, right? It's not necessarily a happy spirit.
This is the Spanish part of it. It's related to risk or mortal panic or anguish. So it's a kind of dark enthusiasm. Lorca has a wonderful essay called Play and Theory of the Duende, which is the sort of takeoff point for my own book, in which he talks about it as a power that everyone senses but no philosopher explains. And he also says all that has black sounds has duende. So it's a kind of demonic anguish that for Lorca comes up from the earth.
Are there any examples that come to mind that would help us understand what you mean?
The singer who might be most immediately available to everyone who seems to be an unquestionable force of duende is Billie Holiday. And when I say that, what I mean is that Billie Holiday seems to me a really great singer who, at the end of her life, even when she lost her voice, even when her technique was gone, she could still put a song over with tremendous emotion. Laurence Olivier seems to me an actor who had duende. It's this sort of dark force. For Lorca and in Spain, bullfighting is a very good analogy for it because it's a pretty clear example of an artist, a bullfighter, working very close to death.
Would you say most of the blues, or at least the great blues singers, have duende?
Almost all the blues has duende. You might say that a lot of spirituals take the duende and try and lift it up. But the blues, as a demonic form, seem to me filled with it. And one of the great examples of this is Robert Johnson, who I think is one of the great blues singers. And there are certain notes that Robert Johnson hits that are so spooky, so eerie, so beyond the conscious control of one's voice you just feel that the demons have come into the room.
You know, the one thing that makes me slightly uncomfortable about all of this is that a lot of the artists and the singers we're talking about, you know, got that soul partly through really self-destructive kinds of lifestyles. I mean, a lot of them, you know, Billie Holiday and others, you know, abused heroin and other kinds of drugs, alcoholism. You know, is this suggesting that to produce a really great work of art, people have to nearly destroy themselves?
I hope not. I mean, I share your concern. I think to produce a really great work of art, a writer, a poet, a novelist, a painter, a musician needs to be in touch with something. And I think that being in touch with that thing, of being vulnerable to that thing, of being open to it, often comes along with a kind of very self-destructive behavior. But I don't think that that self-destructive behavior is crucial to this experience. W.B. Yeats seems to me a marvelous example, who kept this spirit alive into a radically healthy old age. I love the Sufi poets, and one of the poets I love is Ibn Arabi. And one of the reasons I like Ibn Arabi so much is he says, one must control one's thoughts in a dream. So I don't mean to be advocating in any way self-destructive behavior.
It sounds like the Sufis found a kind of spiritual path to the same state, because it struck me that what you're describing is really the longing of the artist for transcendence, for some kind of way to escape the smaller boundaries of the self and to merge into something bigger.
It's very much the case. It's exactly what I'm talking about, and that's why I use the counterfigure not only of the duende, which leads me to the demon, but also the counterfigure of the angel. Near the end of his life, for example, Paul Klee did a series of paintings that I find deeply moving, which are precisely at the line, the boundary line that you're talking about. And I don't think they have to do with any kind of self-destructive behavior, but they were perhaps related to the fact that he recognized that he was going to die and that he was carrying around a kind of fatal illness. But these paintings, he paints human bodies that are sort of struggling in a kind of agonizing way to turn into angels. So he'll have a human body that'll be part arm and then part wing. Hmm. And part of the human being will be turning into spirit. And in a way, this is kind of metaphor for me of the difficult process of taking something earthly, taking something human, something mortal, and trying to transfigure it and transform it into something that is pure spirit.
Has any of what we've been talking about been close to your own experience as a poet?
Yes. I couldn't have written about this with so much passion without having felt some of these feelings myself in my own experience of writing poetry. There are moments in writing where something unexpected comes to you, where something you hadn't planned seems to take over. Now, you might want to just say that's something from the unconscious, or you might want to term it part of the collective unconscious, as Jung did, or you might want to call it the muse. But it all suggests that there's something that's not entirely at the dispensation of your will. Now, one of the terrifying things about writing poetry is there are times where you just don't feel the presence of this and where it just doesn't seem to be happening. But the most exciting moments in writing are when something seems to take over in the process, some kind of spontaneous energy. Now, for me, that doesn't happen when I'm just walking around or I'm not just suddenly struck by lightning. It often happens in the process of working itself. So when I'm working with young poets, I don't say, I don't think you should go off and wander around the world and try to be inspired for a year. I think you should go to work. I mean, I think you should sit down and try to write, and you should read everything you can and study and put yourself under the sway of great works of art. Then, in writing, hopefully, certain things are thrown up to you. And I've certainly had the experience where something just lifts off.
It sounds exhilarating and really wonderful. Is it also scary? You used the word risk.
Well, I think the scary part comes is that you can't entirely control it. It seems to sometimes to be controlling you. And the fact that you can't control it means that you can't always consciously tap it. You know, there's the fear that you won't be able to do it again. I think, abject submission and praying to the muse is entirely in order, even if the muse is only something inside of you. But yes, the element of risk and the element of panic, I suppose, or fear, means that you're not entirely sure what you're going to be able to do. You do your best, and you hope for the best while you're doing it.
Edward Hirsch has got to be pleased with what he's done. Among the many honors he's received are the Prix de Rome, a MacArthur Fellowship, and the National Book Critics Circle Award. His new book is called The Demon and the Angel, Searching for the Source of Artistic Inspiration. Anne Strangechamps talked with him.